Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. This weekend, Pope Benedict XVI issued an apology to victims of sexual abuse in Ireland. But this rare step by the leader of the Roman Catholic Church in the form of a pastoral letter did not go far enough for some. Joining me here in the studio to talk about the scandal and whether the Vatican is doing enough to root out abusers and hold them accountable, the Reverend Thomas Doyle. He's a Roman Catholic priest. He is a canon lawyer, addiction therapist, and advisor to abuse victims. Joining us from NPR studio in New York City, two guests, Joseph Bottom. He's editor of First Things, the nation's largest magazine of religion and public life, and also David Gibson with Politics Daily. We'll take your calls throughout the hour. Join us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Feel free to join us on Facebook or on Twitter. Good morning to all of you, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
David Gibson, if I could start with you, tell us about Pope Benedict's pastoral letter to the people of Ireland.
Well, Diane, it was a letter that was formed, I think, in the wake of the revelations that have been a long time coming in Ireland over several years and really emerged last fall with this Ryan report and Murphy reports, these government investigations, particularly in the Archdiocese of Dublin, kind of the heartland of Catholic Ireland. And this letter, it was preceded by a summit at the Vatican of all the nation's bishops with Pope Benedict XVI to discuss the this tsunami of revelations that's really shattered the church very much and the trust in the institutional church in Ireland. And the Pope at that point promised that before Lent was out, he would issue a more complex and lengthier letter to the people of Ireland, to the Catholics of Ireland, to explain his views on what had gone on, what had gone wrong, and what needed to happen in order to go forward. And that's what this letter was about. And it's generated a lot of debate, a lot of criticism, some praise.
David Gibson, he covers religion for Politics Daily. He is the author of the book, The Rule of Benedict, Pope Benedict XVI, and His Battle with the Modern World. Joseph Bottom, what was your reaction to the letter?
I thought it was quite strong in its way. It has to be said in the context of Vatican speak, which is usually in the subjunctive mood, which is usually taking very long-term views, which is speaks strongly but in a language that the rest of the world can't understand is strong. In that context, this is an astonishingly stern letter. He calls on the priests who did this to come out of the shadows and actually to confess in public what they've done. He calls on the bishops to enact new changes, and he blames them explicitly for what went wrong. He doesn't issue excuses for it. He doesn't take the sort of common lines of defense that one could imagine, like most of this was from 1945 to 1980. Much of this is now, the scandal is now building in a country which is not Catholic anymore, not by a long shot. He doesn't take any of those defenses. Instead, he just says, that these priests and these Catholic laymen who did this in the Catholic institutions in that time betrayed the trust, they betrayed Christ, that in the context, as I say, of Vatican statements, it's incredibly strong.
Joseph Bottom. He's editor of First Things, the nation's largest magazine of religion and public life. He's a commentator on Catholic affairs. Turning to you now, Tom Doyle, did the letter do enough?
Absolutely not. I agree with what Mr. Bottom said about the remarkable nature of the letter and that dimension of it. However, the letter still uses that Vatican passive-aggressive passive, if mistakes were made, etc. I find that the letter doesn't go far enough because it still dances around the essential fundamental issue which is at the root of all of this. What causes the anger, what causes the fury among people is not so much the actual acts of abuse, but the reaction of the hierarchy, the consistent reaction of the hierarchy, which has been to stonewall, to transfer these men from one place to another, and then to try to dance around and save their own image and reputations. And I believe that that's the issue at hand, is looking deeply into the ecclesiastical governance system. Take a look at that and find out why that allowed this to happen. Why something as horrendous as the sexual abuse, the rape and pillage of children and innocent people has been treated the way it has by a church.
The letter concentrated on the Roman Catholic Church in Ireland. Why no mention of Germany?
I believe no mention of Germany because it was this letter was initiated, probably the drafting of it, at the time the bishops of Ireland were in the Vatican, and they, I'm sure, sidestepped the German issue because that's right on the Pope's doorstep. That is really a hot issue in many ways. I believe that the fury in Ireland is what caused this letter to happen. It was not proactive, it was reactive.
And joining us now from Berlin is Vanessa Fermans. She's a correspondent with The Wall Street Journal. Good morning, Vanessa.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Certainly. Can you talk about where things stand right now? The scandal of the Roman Catholic Church in Germany. How did the revelations of abuse come about?
Well, they started in January when around a dozen or so former students of a Jesuit high school in Berlin came forward with allegations of abuse from, well, most of them from many years ago. And that prompted the Jesuits to open a hotline and hire a lawyer to handle cases, and from there on, more revelations started trickling through at other Catholic boarding schools, institutions, and I might add also at some non-religious schools and Protestant institutions, but so far it's been overwhelmingly Catholic institutions.
Of course, the nature of the church in Germany is different from that in Ireland, in that there is separation of church and state, and the people are less dominantly Roman Catholic, correct?
Yes, that's right. The church plays, I would say, almost a more complex role in Germany. You do have most Germans are, you know, overwhelmingly identify themselves as either Catholics or Protestants, but they are not devout. They're not regular churchgoers. Only a small fraction of people regularly go to church. But those people who identify themselves as members of the church pay an income tax, and that allows the church to fund hospitals, schools, nursing homes, and actually play quite a large role in social life.
Can you tell us about the priest who was known to have committed sexual abuse, who had his transfer approved by then Joseph Ratzinger, who was bishop at the time, now Benedict XVI?
Yes, that's definitely been one of the most or more explosive cases to come to light here in Germany, not only because it touches the Pope, but also because here's clearly a case of a priest who was then allowed to continue in priestly duties for decades after he was known to be a sexual child abuse offender. And this particular priest worked in Essen, a northwestern German city, and was in 1980 found to have committed acts of sexual child abuse. And he was then transferred to the diocese or archdiocese of Munich, where the Pope, then Joseph, Archbishop Ratzinger, was the archbishop, and apparently was part of the decision to approve the transfer. But the Vatican and the Archdiocese have been quick to say that he then had no more interaction with any decision-making regarding that priest. And the priest was eventually returned to pastoral duties, but the Archdiocese says a subordinate was completely responsible for that decision. And last week, the Archdiocese also reported that this priest, who had been still working as a priest in a small Bavarian town, was suspended after these allegations came to light.
Vanessa Fermans, she's a correspondent with the Wall Street Journal in Berlin. What is your reaction, Tom Doyle?
My reaction is that the people in the Munich Chancery are trying to cover for the Pope. There's no way that he could not have been involved in the acceptance of this man into the Diocese of Munich from another diocese, especially because of the reason for the acceptance. And there's no way he could not have been directly involved in making the assignment of that man to
who him. Is he?
The Pope, as Archbishop of Munich.
Thomas Doyle. He's a Roman Catholic priest, canon lawyer, addiction therapist, and advisor to abuse victims. Short break, right back. And we're back talking about the scandal across Europe in regard to priests within the Roman Catholic Church and accusations of alleged sexual abuse. David Gibson is in New York. He covers Religion for Politics Daily. Joseph Bottom is at STAME NPR studio in New York. He's editor of First Things, the nation's largest magazine of religion and public life. Here in the studio is Thomas Doyle. He's a Roman Catholic priest, canon lawyer, addiction therapist, and advisor to abuse victims. On the line with us from Berlin is Vanessa Fermans. She's correspondent with the Wall Street Journal. Let me ask you, Joseph Bottom, how serious do you think this problem has become for the Church, the Vatican, and Roman Catholic priests?
Well, when you say this problem, I think we have to divide it into two problems.
All right.
One is the actual abuse, ongoing abuse of children or young people by Catholic officials, whether in the clergy or in the lay people in the Catholic institutions. The other problem is the anti-Catholic feeling generated by all of this and the scandal of its revelation. Remember, the vast majority of this happened many years ago, or the vast majority of what's been reported happened many years ago. And the scandal is a scandal of cover-up. The scandal is a scandal of perception. The scandal that's really going on in Europe now is a scandal of Catholicism's role, unconsidered role in those societies. In terms of the first problem, the ongoing abuse of children, I think the Church has moved very, very rapidly to ensure, insofar as it's possible, to ensure that this isn't going on right now. You know, there are sickos everywhere at some level. You can't keep them out perfectly out of the public schools or out of the bus drivers or out of psychologist's office, child psychologist's office. So the Church is unlikely to eliminate all of them everywhere, but they can do a much better job of controlling the situations in which this these kinds of things can happen, and they seem to be moving in that direction quite rapidly, in fact. In fact, the Irish plans that are in place now to deal with future interaction of priests and children are being adopted as a model by Protestant churches everywhere or elsewhere around the world. In terms of the second problem, which is the real problem in Europe today, the problem of the scandal of the long ongoing cover-up since World War II of accusations like this, the scandal of a situation in which basically no one in Europe goes to church, but this church is still massively intertwined with government, as in Germany. 2% of Germans are in church on a Sunday, and yet massive government dollars are collected and paid to them out of old agreements. All of that needs to be shaken up. All of that is going to be shaken up by the perception, quite accurate in many ways, that the Church spent a long time sending these guys to things like addiction therapy, sending them to things like, you know, psychological programs that would cure them of what they were told at the time was a psychological disorder instead of a sin. We had an amazingly corrupt generation of priests since World War II, from World War II up through about 1980, 1990 even, and this is the fruit of it.
Tom Doyle, how do you react?
Well, first off, I guess I'm part of that amazingly corrupt generation of priests, and that's I really have a serious problem with that perception. It was not an amazingly corrupt generation of priests. And I will say this, I have been involved, deeply involved with this issue for 25 years. I know victims. I've known them intimately. Some of the most painful moments of my life have been sitting with the mothers and fathers of men and women, boys and girls, as they have poured out their hearts and their souls over what has happened to their children. And I think one problem with all of this on the part of the bishops, the papacy, they need to really sit down with the people whom this is all about. It's the victims. Secondly, sexual abuse of a child, pedophilia, of a young adolescent, ephebophilia, it may be sinful in some moral codes, but it is primarily a sexual disorder. It's defined as a sexual disorder. These men certainly cannot be cured, but can be helped in some ways, I suspect. But it is a sexual disorder, and it's not a moral issue primarily. You can't turn it off and on with your will.
Vanessa Furmans, can I ask you how serious you believe this problem to be in Germany, especially in Munich?
Well, it's. I guess it's. It depends on what you're looking at. It seems that at the moment, the revelations that are coming out are still small in number compared to what you've seen in Ireland, what you've seen in the U.S. At the same time, though, it's still actually very early, and more revelations are coming out by the day. And people are angry. They're sad, but they're also angry. Many had expected that or had hoped that the Pope would say at least something by brief mention of Germany in his letter this weekend, particularly because it is his homeland, but he didn't. The other problem for the church here is that it could also not just be a social institutional problem for them, but a financial one as well, because Germans do pay the taxes that fund the majority of church revenue, and you've all seen some church members step out of the church, even in reaction to this. There's been a brief surge, at least an early surge of people stepping out of the church, which means they're no longer paying those revenues.
How active has the German government been in the investigation itself?
Well, you've certainly seen political leaders speaking out about it, that it's a horrible thing that's happened. The justice minister here in particular has been quite proactive, or I should say vocal, about what's happened, and she's actually attracted a lot of criticism herself for some of the remarks she's made. Some of her fellow lawmakers in the German government have criticized her for being anti-Catholic for some of the remarks she's made. She and some other lawmakers have called for a round table with the church, a summit, so to speak, to get into why exactly this has happened and how to prevent further abuse in the future. The Catholic Church, in response, has said they would do that, but they really do refuse to be singled out. They say that they are willing to do a roundtable, but only if other institutions are involved as well, that sexual abuse is treated as a societal problem and not just a Catholic Church problem.
David Gibson, why are we seeing so many victims coming forward now? As Vanessa has said, it's early in the process, and yet we're seeing more revelations by the day.
Well, I think it's really repeating in many respects the dynamic and the cycle that happened in the United States in 2002 with reports from the investigative reports from the Boston Globe that really kind of blew open the scandal, which had been reported on in various spots for years before that. But it really took a kind of galvanizing report and a galvanizing kind of incidents and personalities to bring this out in the open. And as it did so, we're seeing repeating the same kind of pattern where it emboldens both public officials and investigators, as Vanessa was talking about, to criticize or even launch investigations of a church that they wouldn't have touched before. But it also really emboldens victims to come forward. You get the one victim who comes forward, and that encourages someone else who had remained silent for decades, which is often the case, as Tom Doyle knows, to come forward. And then bit by bit, you kind of unleash this what can become a torrent of claims and accusations and charges, often again from years earlier. And this is the real danger, I think, for the Pope and for the Vatican, in the sense that this is such a fluid situation. The letter to the Irish was promised and was formed really a couple of months ago or several weeks ago, before a lot of these revelations and charges, et cetera, were coming out and sweeping across Europe. So the Vatican always has had a bit of a problem with communications and being behind the curve. And I think you're seeing that again now. They're having difficulty kind of keeping up with this incredibly fast-paced crisis, which is spreading. And at the same time, they don't want to, and the Pope doesn't want to address this crisis, I think, particularly in his native Germany, while it is still such a fluid situation. He doesn't want to issue some statement, from the Vatican, from the throne of St. Peter, and then have incidents on the ground change very much next week, so he has to do it again.
Tom Doyle, Joseph Bottom talked about the fact that these are incidents that took place perhaps 2-3 decades ago and just now coming out. Can we be sure of that?
No. There is a lot of truth to the fact that there have been many, many more men and women coming out now and in the past few years who were abused many years ago. But the reason generally is that it's only now that they feel emboldened and strong enough. Many have said, we never said anything because we were afraid that God would get even with us if we hurt the church or we were afraid no one would listen to us, we would not be believed. And all of this has made that possible. There have been, one of the things that has been said is that this is a result of a, as Mr. Bottom said, a wave of immorality, I guess, in the 70s. Well, how do you explain the fact that there's a lot of individuals who were sexually abused in the 50s and in the 60s, and even some in the 40s who are still alive? The other part of that issue, I believe, is the fact that, well, there still are, it's still going on, not as much as it was before because of...
How do we know that?
Well, we know that because they come forward and they report. They come forward to victim support groups. They go to the police. I get phone calls on a regular basis and refer them to others. So it's not, the volume is nowhere near what it was before. For one reason, there aren't that many priests, and people are simply, you know, they're so shy about being around priests now, and the image of the priest has significantly changed. But
Vanessa, let me ask you, are any of the people coming forward in the past few weeks and months young, or are they mostly those who felt they were abused in the 60s, 70s, 80s?
Yes, it's definitely the latter. There are a few cases of people from, I would say, more recent decades, say the 90s, but the overwhelming number of reports have been from, I would say, the 70s and the 60s, even some from the 50s.
Vanessa Fuhrman, she's reporting from Berlin for The Wall Street Journal. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. The question that perhaps comes up in many people's minds, Joseph Bottoms, is whether, in fact, the church should reconsider the issue of celibacy. Where are you on that?
I just don't see it. If we had clear evidence that this didn't occur in churches with a married clergy, then I would say, you know, we had some objective empirical evidence, but it just doesn't exist. Look at the abuse rates at the Episcopal institutions in Canada, which came out after the scandals were revealed in 2001, 2002, and the Boston Globe broke that story of old cover-ups. The stuff that came out in Canada is just jaw-droppingly bad as anything else that occurred. And it was undertaken by Episcopal clergy. So we don't have evidence that this is a problem that's exclusive to the Catholic demand for celibacy. If we did, it wouldn't occur in the Orthodox Church. It wouldn't occur in the Episcopal Church. That can't be the explanation because the empirical evidence doesn't support it.
Tom Doyle.
We have to look for something else.
What he said is absolutely true, but the issue, the relationship between celibacy and the sexual abuse phenomena is not so much related directly at the abusers, but celibacy, as one priest described at one time, is like clerical dress. There's something about it that supports the mysticism, the mysterious nature, the remoteness of the clerical subculture. And the clerical subculture has a major, major part to play in the cover-up, in the way victims are treated, in the obsessive concern about the image and the stature of the institutional church. Another dimension of the celibacy issue is the way young men are formed to be celibates. In the years when I went through, all you were told was how big the sins would be that you would commit if you violated in any manner, way, shape, or form the obligations of celibacy. Men were basically urged not to develop intimate relationships, not sexual relationships, but intimate relationships. There's no question that the attitude toward women that was projected was seriously warped. In many instances, women were put up as the temptresses, etc. So celibacy doesn't cause a man to become sexually dysfunctional. But what it does do, it has it's a complex but a direct relationship with the concept of the cover-up.
David Gibson, do you believe that the issue of celibacy will again be debated within the church?
I think it will, but for also... other reasons, such as the vocation shortage, the shortage of the number of priests out there, which is a real problem for the church, and people are increasingly looking to other churches that have a married clergy that seem, you know, that have more pastors out there to you know, be ministers to the flock. But I also think another problem, not with celibacy per se, but with that's linked to the priest shortage and the vocation shortage, is the kind of young men who are often attracted to the seminary, who might be going there to hide some of their psychosexual problems or to sublimate them. And that's where you get the real problems. It's not a liberal kind of conservative issue. It's really, you know, the kind, you know, the seminaries are looking for warm bodies to fill the spaces there, and some of the young men who they're getting in may not be suitable for that, or they may be going there. It's not something that the church authorities are imposing on them, as in Father Doyle's day, so much as something, baggage that perhaps some people are bringing with them. That said, just the research shows that since psychological counseling has been put into place since the 1980s, the number of those abusive priests has really plummeted in all seminaries.
David Gibson, he covers religion for Politics Daily. Short break. We'll be right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, working to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. By Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build strong customer relationships with email marketing. ConstantContact.com. And by Cabot Creamery Cooperative, five generations of New England and New York farm families working together to produce naturally aged traditional Vermont cheddar cheese. This is NPR.
Journalist Michael Lewis on the contrarian investors who made enormous profits as the world's financial markets melted. How Wall Street's culture has and has not changed in the two decades since he wrote Liar's Poker, The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. We're back with your emails and phone calls. Here's one. A question for Tom Doyle. Why not excommunicate those priests? I am a Protestant converted Catholic. How in the world do I defend my church and my faith? We must show the other churches we are doing more than acknowledging the problem. What's your view on excommunication, Tom Doyle?
Well, excommunication, of course, is somebody is basically kicked out of the Catholic Church. That has not been used as a penalty for priests who've offended in this way.
Why not?
I don't know. I mean, it's an option. The Pope certainly could do it if he wished. But the tendency over the past several years that I've been involved, 25, as I mentioned before, has in many ways to almost favor the priests, to protect the priests. And one of the glaring holes, lacunae in this whole thing is the obvious lukewarm concern on the part of the institution for the men and women who have been sexually abused. This is often described as soul murder, and I've worked with many of these people. I've seen the spiritual damage and devastation that has been done. So taking care of the priests, punishing them, putting them out, you know, that's certainly an important issue. And finally, they're doing it. The church is looking at it, but not because they wanted to, but because they've been forced to.
Now, you have said or questioned whether the governing structure of the Vatican is really capable of handling these crises.
I don't believe it is. If it were, you and I wouldn't be sitting here talking this morning. This issue has been known, well known to the Vatican, and it was known to Pope John Paul II in detail in 1984. And since then, there's been a lot of information transferred over there, because it did not start in 2002. The public revelations came in 1984. I don't believe the governing structure, is capable of dealing with it, because it's basically a monarchical structure where the Pope and the bishops believe that the Almighty appointed them as the directors, as the leaders, and that they are synonymous with the Church, and that their welfare is of the utmost importance in preserving the Church. Others, and myself included, see the Church more as the body of Christ, the people of God. And the most important people there aren't so much the ones in the high positions, but those who are suffering, those who are rejected and are vulnerable.
Joseph Bottom, is the governing structure of the Vatican capable of handling the crisis?
Well, again, we want to distinguish the crisis into two elements. One is actual abuse of children. The other is the response to these long-delayed revelations finally coming out, and the shame of having watched generations of priests do this to little boys and little girls. It's just horrendously awful. And the cover-up, as Father Doyle described, is a serious thing. Is what this scandal is about now. With regard to the first crisis, the Church is eminently suited to solve the problem insofar as it can be solved by weeding out the people who do this and not giving them positions of authority or trust with children. And they're working on that, and they seem actually to be doing a fairly good job.
What about the idea? Excuse me. What about the idea of excommunication? Where are you on that, Joseph Bottom?
I'm a little astonished at Father Doyle's apparent belief that there's no mercy for these people in Christ, that they can be stripped of their priestly duties. Absolutely. That the Church can ensure that they're not ever put in a position where they're with children. Absolutely. That the Church can turn them over to the state authorities with all that they know. Absolutely. But that to be excommunicated means that you're saying that there is no chance within the Catholic Church for Christ's mercy to reach this person. Strikes me as really unpastoral.
I don't think you heard what I said. I didn't say they should be excommunicated. She asked me why it doesn't take place, and I said I don't know, and it's certainly an option they could use. I will say I've had significant contact over the years with the perpetrating priests as well as the victims, and I believe that they are human. They are deeply flawed, if you want to use that word, but they are entitled to compassion and mercy just as anyone else is. It's very difficult to swallow that for many. But that's the fact, and that's really, I've had many victims even say, I feel sorry for Father so-and-so, but the one I don't feel sorry for is the bishop, because he let it happen. So I don't have that attitude toward the perpetrating priests. I don't see them as completely washouts, that they should be rejected and pounded into the ground at all.
All right, to Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Good morning, Robert. You're on the air.
Yes. I'm a 60-year-old male who was abused by a priest when I was 12 years old. And the one thing I've been waiting to hear is a big I'm sorry from the Pope and everybody. And that, please forgive us. And I want to see an attempt at reconciliation and healing. Until that happens, I'm not going into Catholic Church again.
David Gibson, do you think that's likely to happen?
I think that empathize very much as I possibly can with the caller, but I think that has happened. The Pope has expressed regret, but I think it's and I think you'll probably see that again. And I think Local bishops have done that to a great degree. The bishops' conference in the United States has done that to a great degree. But I think what people are looking for beyond statements of regret or apology is a more personal accountability and a more corporate accountability, shall I say. And also not just, again, linking up with what we were just talking about, you know, about pounding the priests, but also in the upper levels of the authority of the bishops who oversaw them, who still tend to get a pass, both in Benedict's letter to the Irish Catholics, but also in all of these other kinds of things. If a priest physically abuses a child, a horrendous crime like that, that sin is held up and is vilified, and rightly so, very much. But again, the management problems, to use a very technical word, of bishops who may have, you know, kept these men in circulation and led to more scandals, that's the real problem. I think that's the kind of concrete accountability that people are looking for, more than just words. That's my experience
in
talking with victims.
My experience has been that the apologies from the Pope on down generally are received by most of the victims that I've had contact with, direct and indirect, as insincere and insufficient. They believe that these are statements that are made because they have to make them. And one of the things that is irritating consistently is the use of the passive. If mistakes were made, what the victims, and they are the most important group in this equation, absolutely.
Exactly.
These are the people that need to be concerned about before anyone else. What they want to hear is, I'm sorry that I was involved in a situation that caused you to be hurt and harmed. They want to see someone accept sincerely the responsibility for what has happened to them. And all of the apologies, the hand-wringing is of naught. What the people want to see is action and not words.
Robert, I'm so sorry for what happened to you.
Right, but what he said is, that's exactly what I want to hear. And I know a lot of my brother feels the same way. You know, he's so right. We've just got to hear it personally and
all right.
Up front.
Thank you so much for calling. Let's go to Gary in University Park, Maryland. Good morning. You're on the air.
Thank you. My wife and I have left the Catholic Church because of the abuse crisis, and we've been distressed that American lay Catholics and Catholic priests have been so passive about this abuse crisis in this country. I wonder if your panel would venture to explain why American Catholics are not so deeply angered by this as those in Ireland and Germany. Few American priests have had the courage of Father Thomas Doyle, who knows the deep damage that this does to a child.
David Gibson.
Well, I think it's there's a parallel, perhaps an unfortunate parallel, with Congress, where everybody hates Congress and our leaders in Washington, but they tend to reelect their own representative time after time. A lot of people like you have left the church for a lot of reasons, and the sexual abuse crisis was one of the precipitating reasons for many people. But a lot of people like being Catholic still. So it's an important thing to them. They're willing to, you know, they're not Catholic because of the Pope or because of the bishop, or sometimes even because of the priest. They are there because they are Catholic and because of their Catholic faith and the culture and the traditions they grew up with. So they don't want to – they want to stay and fight. And some of them may not be fighting loudly enough. It's tough to be an activist in a church that you go to for worship and sanctuary from the other 6 days of the week.
Vanessa, I'd like to understand how people in Germany are reacting. What have you heard? What have you read?
Well, I think it's mostly a reaction of anger. There is a lot of anger directed toward the church, both within the church among Catholics and those outside of it. I think quite similar to the reaction you saw in the U.S. and even more so in Ireland. I was just in Munich and in Regensburg in Bavaria for a few days and spoke to many people who would identify themselves as devout Catholics. And there was a lot of sadness and also anger, but I would say overwhelmingly sadness, because they recognize that this is a scandal that's going to do quite a bit of damage to the church, a church they care a lot about.
You wanted to make a comment regarding apology, Tom Doyle.
Yes, I would. As I said, I've been involved personally with victims of sexual abuse, men and women, young and old, for 25 years. One of the things that I've done consistently with everyone, just about everyone I've met, and it's probably the most important thing I've done in my life, has been to apologize to them. I tell them I'm still part of the system, even though I'm far out. But I want to tell you how deeply sorry I am for what has happened to you. It's an extremely painful, moving moment for me and for them. And what I've heard from almost everyone, with one or two exceptions, is you are the first person to ever say that to us.
Joseph Bottom, do you think that these apologies, if made in the active case rather than the passive case, and made more directly to victims of abuse, whether those victims had the occurrence 20 years ago, 10 years ago, do you think that that would help?
Well, anything that could help the pain that these people are feeling is absolutely to be done and has to be done. But I think apologies are not enough. I think the people want action. And the action has to involve getting rid of and penalizing the bishops and the priests who did this and the bishops who covered up for them. We saw an amazing amount of corruption over decades. And the people who did this have to be removed from positions of power. They have to be made to suffer. They have to understand that what they were excusing was sin. What they were watching was a clergy getting corrupted, and what they were doing was hiding it and in the name of a church that had institutional ties and institutional standing that they didn't want to give up. The Pope himself speaks of this in the letter to Ireland, and he needs to do more of it with regard to Germany. There ought to be house cleaning. These bishops who covered it up have to go, although most of them are gone, but more, any of them who are left have to go. And the church has to understand, and the Vatican has to understand in the appointment of new bishops, that it can't put in anyone who is touched by this scandal.
Joseph Bottom, he's editor of First Things, the nation's largest magazine of religion and public life. And you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And let's go now to Jacksonville, Florida. Good morning, Ben. You're on the air. Ben, are you there? All right. Let's go then to Deborah in Cape Cod, Massachusetts. Good morning.
Hi. I just want to say that from hearing everything I've been hearing about the scandals, especially with Boston, it just reminds me so much of what happens in families. I come from a family where incest was very big, from grandparents to brothers to aunts and uncles, and no one said anything. I mean, you knew people were being molested, girls, but no one did anything about it. And it just sounds the same as, you know, because you're not supposed to air your dirty laundry. Just sounds the same to me with the church. And, you know, I had a daughter, and when she was born, my aunt asked me if I was going to let my father babysit. And I said, what are you, crazy? And I never spoke to her again. But that seems to be the reaction, you know, just forget it, sweep it under the rug, and it seems to be the same thing with the church. And I'm just assuming because it's this enclosed group where outsiders aren't allowed in.
Deborah, I'm so sorry. It sounds as though you've had a tough situation to live through. Is the Catholic Church going to sweep this under the rug, or will there be stronger action? Tom Doyle.
First off, I would like to say that Deborah's perception is right on target. That's exactly what has happened. They will not be able to sweep it under the rug as extensively as has happened in the past, because the institutional church has lost control of this issue. It no longer has control. It is on the defensive. The control is in the hands of the secular world. The courts have made it quite clear what will happen, the victims themselves and the media. So they won't be able to sweep it under the rug, and they'll continue to be forced to be accountable. The bishops have done nothing proactive about helping victims, about ensuring there won't be abuse in the future. They've done put together a lot of programs, a lot of things like that, but it's all been forced. None of this would have happened had this explosion not taken place over the years and with the publicity given to victims and abuse.
David Gibson, very quickly, we have just a few seconds. Is the papacy of Benedict XVI in any trouble?
You're not going to see the Pope resign. That's not going to happen. What's really the problem and the challenge he faces is whether he has the credibility to preach to this Christian heartland in Europe that he wants to re-Christianize. That's one of his priorities.
All
Popes
right.
for decades have said they cannot command. They have to convince.
David Gibson, he covers Religion for Politics Daily. He's the author of The Rule of Benedict, Pope Benedict XVI, and His Battle with the Modern World. Joseph Bottom, editor of First Things. The Reverend Thomas Doyle, Roman Catholic priest, canon lawyer. And Vanessa Fermans of The Wall Street Journal. Thank you all. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.